Well, thank you very much for coming. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this public lecture here at the LSE. It's sponsored by the Financial Markets Group. And today we're extremely honored to have Professor Richard Roll visiting to give a lecture titled Market Liquidity, Trading Activity, and Order Imbalance. I think this is going to be a fascinating lecture. Professor Roll is one of the true founding fathers, if you like, of the modern theory of finance. I don't think we'll group him together with Irving Fisher, but since he's a little younger. But certainly when one thinks of the people that have built finance as a discipline today, a major university discipline, and one that's had a terrific impact in the real world and is continuing to do so, one of the first names that comes to mind is Richard Roll. Professor Roll is an all-state professor at University of California, Los Angeles, where he's stayed throughout most of his academic career after having graduated from the University of Chicago in the late 60s. Apart from having written a large number of papers with most of the students in this room either are or will become familiar with if they want to do good in their exams, Professor Roll is a, I think, a fairly distinguished pilot, wine grower, and motorcyclist. But today he's going to talk about his true love. What's that? The American water industry, I think. So, without more ado, because you're here to listen to Professor Roll and not me, I'll introduce Professor Roll. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come over and give a talk on liquidity, which, as you see, is something that we all have an intuitive feeling for, but don't really know what it is. At least I didn't until I started working on it. The papers I'm going to talk about, actually two papers, or a combination of two papers, I hope, today, in the hour or so that we've allotted for this. And I'll show you these PowerPoint slides. Now, the main reason for showing you PowerPoint is so I can remember what I'm supposed to talk about. I've gotten to that age where, unless I have a few audiovisual prompts, I kind of forget where we're going. So it helps keep us organized. I hope you can all see the screen up there. So let me get started here. This first paper that I'm going to talk about is called Market Liquidity and Trading Activity. And it was co-authored with two other people, Tarun Chordia, who's a professor at Emory University in Atlanta, and Avanidar Subramaniam, who's my colleague at the UCLA. And just to show you, I'm the second listed author. My co-authors are a bit younger. Here's a latest photo of Subramanian, you know, circa 1960, that I was able to get hold of. Seriously, there are some unanswered questions about liquidity. One is, how much do liquidity and trading activity vary over time? The second is, are there regularities that we can predict, such as seasonalities? And what is the impact of recent market conditions on liquidity? What causes the daily movements in liquidity, which I'll show you are fairly substantial? But these questions, of course, have basic scientific merit, intrinsic merit in themselves, but they're also important to the world of practical affairs, because investors, of which I am one also in private life, depend on liquidity to develop trading strategies. And we've had many examples where liquidity kind of dries up over broad market segments and causes rather disastrous consequences for prices. So I don't think I have to persuade you very long that practical people who are investors are very, very concerned about the question of liquidity and how that changes over time and what causes it to change. And the same thing could be said about regulators and exchange officials, because they too would like to have a better handle on why liquidity varies in time and how to combat disruptions in markets that cause them to basically melt down. I also think that this could shed light on the time series behavior of equity returns. In particular, it might tell us something more than we already know about what causes assets to differ cross-sectionally in their expected returns, as well as how they behave over time. Well, you may wonder, why don't existing studies provide answers to these questions? And the simple reason is that most studies of liquidity, most empirical studies, have been restricted necessarily to rather short time spans. There's not a lot of intraday data, transactions data, going back for more than a few years. There's an enormous task of handling intraday data. And as a result, both the computers and research assistants tend to have meltdown themselves when they begin studying liquidity. And that has led to most studies not really covering a long enough time span or a broad enough sample to really get a handle on what causes liquidity to vary. We need a sufficiently broad and long sample to span a variety of events and to bring statistical reliability. And the sample that I'm going to show you in this paper is, I think, at least in the right direction. It has more than 1,300 stocks on average, that is on average over the days in the sample, about 2,800 trading days. And those days span a period from 1988 to 1998 inclusive, in which we set out to measure liquidity for every individual stock at every transaction on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, I know that, you know, in London, you have lots of data too, and I'm presently engaged in doing this for Tokyo as well, so forgive me a little bit for showing you these American data. We just started there and hope to extend something like this to other markets as well. Well, what are the measures of liquidity and trading activity that that we're going to talk about? These are proxies for liquidity because they're not really, there's no real definition of what liquidity really is. So empirically, we're going to look at things like spreads, like bid-ask spreads. And there we have two types that are often used in the literature, quoted and effective spreads. The proportional quoted and effective spreads, that is after you divide the spread by the market price. And third, the depth. And the depth is the quantity of shares that the market makers are prepared to execute at the quoted prices that they quote on the exchange. So in the case of the New York Stock Exchange, when the specialist, which is the market maker on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, makes a price quote, a bid and an ask, corresponding to that quote is a depth of shares that is being offered, that is guaranteed to be executed at that price. So if you keep that in mind, depth is also sort of somehow related to the quantity that you'll be able to execute, and we'll see that that also is an important variable to take a look at. In terms of the trading activity variables, we're going to look at share and dollar volume, at the number of trades that occur during a time period, and also at the number of stocks that trade during a particular time period. So those are the three things. Now later I'm going to talk about also order imbalances, that is differences between the supply and demand of shares coming into the market from the outside, but we'll postpone that till the toward the end of the talk. Well, just to be precise about what these liquidity measures are, here's a table which lists the quoted spread, the proportional quoted spread, depth, the effective spread, the proportional effective spread, their acronyms, and how they're defined. You can see that, for instance, the proportional quoted spread is just the difference between the ask price and the bid price divided by the midpoint of the quote. And that's different than the proportional effective spread, which is the difference between the transactions price and the midpoint of the quote divided by the transactions price. That's the last line of that table. So those two things will have different properties, and you can see that, generally speaking, the effective spread will be something less than the quoted spread, because people who have some ability to bargain with the market maker can have trades that occur within the spreads. Now, the depth number is the quantity number there, and that's just an average. We're going to take it as an average of the quoted ask and bid depths that occur for every trade. Well, our objective here is to document the intertemporal movements in those empirical constructs that I just showed you, and to identify things that would determine why they change over time. The possible determinants that we knew before we came in here involve things like these. For instance, we know that the spreads involve inventory carrying costs. In fact, in market microstructure literature, there's basically two paradigms which have developed. One is the inventory paradigm, and one is the asymmetric information paradigm. And they have different implications for why market makers do the things they do and why liquidity changes as it does. But here are some things that come from either one of the two paradigms that might be possible determinants of these liquidity constructs. Inventory carrying costs, regularities such as day of the week effects or holidays, technical momentum strategies such as recent trends, which would cause people to trade more or less than they traded before, information surges, contemporaneous price movements, which are induced by individuals with perhaps asymmetric information, or even asymmetric information about macroeconomic events. So we're going to try to quantify those things and see if we can relate them to the liquidity and trading activity variables. But let me repeat what the data really include. They cover the years 1998, New York Exchange stocks. There are about 35 million stock day records and about 3 billion transactions in these stocks in that period. There actually were two sources. From 88 to 92, there was the Institute for Study of Securities Markets data collected trade-by-trade data. And from 93 on, the New York Stock Exchange has been supplying what it calls trade and automated quotations data that you can get from the New York Stock Exchange. It's about a CD-ROM or two full of data for every month. So you have to, you know, load this on the supercomputer and get and boil it down to a manageable size. Basically, we have every single trade time-stamped, the transaction price, the number of shares traded, and with the trade, we have the associated quote that existed at least five seconds just prior to the trade, the bid-ask spread and the depth. So with every trade, we've got a quote associated with that trade and a depth associated with that. Obviously, from the trades themselves, we get the trading activity numbers, but the spreads and the percentage spreads can do that. Well, you know, that you can't do you can't do an empirical regression with 35 billion data points. So what we did is we tried to boil this down into a more manageable size. The first thing we did is we added up the transactions data daily for individual stocks. And for each stock, we averaged all these numbers across the trading day. So the spreads, the percentage spreads, the depth, and all that stuff. And the volume is aggregated by individual trades across the day. The number of trades, of course, we can tabulate that. And we add up with a daily point for each individual stock. We also had to deal with how we wanted to let stocks come into the sample. So individual stocks are included here if they're present at the beginning and end of the year, and we start all over each calendar year with a slightly different sample. We'll see later when you look at the numbers that has had an impact on around the year end, which we'll have to deal with. The stock had to remain listed on the New York Stock Exchange for the whole year, and we didn't allow any special kinds of securities to come in because their liquidity could be conceivably different than normal equities, such as foreign stocks, real estate investment trusts, and stuff like that. Of course, any trade that's out of sequence, and when you're dealing with this much data, as you can well imagine, there are lots of times when you run into data which are obviously incorrect. And sometimes we have transactions that occur at midnight and stuff like that. Well, that's obviously not a correct one, so we throw that We can't have a negative spread or a negative depth or a negative price, which also occurs. Those of you who are used to working on standard price tapes that don't have many of these errors, these transactions data are a lot more trouble to work with. Well, let's take a look now at the averages of the liquidity measures for the 2,779 trading days in the sample. And here's a table which I want to point out just a few things about. For instance, the number of firms on average was about 1,326. The average quoted spread in dollars was 0.208, so just over 20 cents was the average quoted spread. During this time period, of course, the minimum quoted spread in the early part of the time period was 12.5 cents, 1/8 of a dollar, and that changed later in the time period to 1/16 of a dollar. Now, New York Stock Exchange has got a minimum spread of 1 cent, and we'll see later when we look at these things what the effect is of the minimum tick size on various measures of liquidity and trading activity. The percentage quoted spread on average was 1.497, just about 1.5%, and the effective spread was about 14 cents, and the percentage effective spread was just about 1%. So you can see that the effective spread, the percentage effective spread, are below the quoted spread and the percentage quoted spread by, well, in the case of the percentage spread, it's about 0.5% lower, which indicates that quite a few trades occur within the quoted spread. Then the final column over there is the depth number in shares. The typical average quoted depth is about 6,200 shares, but of course that varies widely. There's some companies that the typical quoted depth is never more than 100, and there's some that it's very large. So there's a big cross-sectional variance in that number, which is indicated by the standard deviation or sigma that's there. And the minimum and maximum numbers are down at the bottom. The trading activity variables are shown here. So the typical average share volume in thousands is about 183,000 shares a day. The dollar volume of a typical stock is about 7 million, and there are about 109 trades a day in a typical stock, and about $63,000 per trade. That's the last column there. You can also see there the minimum and maximum vary widely. For instance, if you look at the dollar volume, the average dollar volume for individual stocks varies from 0.83 million to about 28 million per day, and the number of trades also is got quite a bit of cross-sectional volatility. Now here's a table that has in it liquidity and trading activity daily percentage changes, the absolute values of those daily percentage changes. So the way to read this table is, if you look at the first number there in the top left, it's 1.572. That's the percentage change from day to day in the quoted spread. We take the percentage change, we take the absolute value of that percentage change, and we average that over time. It's a measure of the volatility of the day-to-day changes in these numbers. So The thing that I want you to look at this table and think about is, if you look at the second panel of the table, there's a thing called D price. It's a percentage change in the price of the average stock on a given day. So the value of that, which is 0.555, is something like the volatility of a typical stock measured in absolute value terms. Now, we all know how noisy stock prices are. They're very, very volatile on a daily basis, and we're all used to that. But the thing that is remarkable when you look at these numbers is the price volatility is much less than the liquidity and trading activity volatility. Every single number in this table is quite a bit higher than the price volatility. So if you look at the spread numbers on the top panel, You can see they're in the order of 1.5 to 2%. The depth number on a percentage basis, the depth number is 4.8% per day, and the volume numbers are 14 and 15%, which are just orders of magnitude more volatile than prices themselves. Now, I didn't expect this when we first started this. I didn't realize that these liquidity constructs would be so much more volatile than price, than returns themselves are volatile. But indeed they are. But the interesting thing, one reason that that's very interesting is because it means that there's a lot of volatility to explain. It's not that these things are constants over time. They're fluctuating from day to day by big amounts, and that means that we don't have something that's just sitting there not doing much. Well, when we look at the time series properties of these numbers, of course, there's no arbitrage that will keep them from being autocorrelated over time. And so if you look at the autocorrelation coefficients for the different constructs, which are given in this table here, you can see that in the top panel, the liquidity variables, and you read those off, are the percentage change in quoted spread and the percentage quoted spread and the effective spread and depth and in dollar depth. If you look at the first order daily autocorrelation of those numbers, they're all negative. And they're significantly negative. If it's shown in yellow there, it indicates that it's statistically significant with a p-value of 0.0000. With this much data, you can get those kinds of p-values. And even the second lagged autocorrelation coefficient is quite negative, with one exception, the percentage effective spread. And remember, these are already the percentage changes. So we're looking at the autocorrelations and the percentage changes from day to day, and they're very prone to mean revert on a daily basis. The same thing is true of the trading activity variables, with the exception of the price, because the price itself, the percentage change in the price, is the return. And of course, it's not autocorrelated because it would offer an arbitrage opportunity if it were. And you can see that exception in the first line of the second part of the paper there. It has no significant autocorrelation out to 5 daily lags. Another thing I want to point out here is that there's a little bit of evidence that at lag 5, which is 5 trading days or 1 week, these things are positively autocorrelated, which means that there could be a weekly seasonal. So that, and we'll see later, in fact, that is definitely the case. There is a weekly seasonal in these numbers. Here's a plot over the whole time period. You probably can't read these dates, but this is January 1988. And the end of the graph is December 1998, so there are 11 years plotted there. The upper graph there is the average value of the quoted spread over all stocks in the market on a given day. And those are equally weighted averages. You see the EW there at the panel heading. And the lower graph is the effective spread averaged over all stocks in a given day and plotted over time. Now, when you look at those things, you can see that it looks like there's a somewhat of a negative trend in both of them over time. But one thing that you've got to, if you look out here, there's a big jump at this point. See that big jump there? That coincides with the period that the New York Stock Exchange went from a minimum tick size of 1/8 dollar to a minimum tick size of 1/16 of a dollar. So when the minimum tick size was changed, and that was purely done by fiat, by the directors of exchange, that had a dramatic impact on the average spreads that were quoted and the effective spreads as well. We'll see also that on the percentage quoted in effective spreads. Remember, the percentage quoted in effective spreads are spreads where the price has been is used as a divisor. So these are the vertical axis here is the spread divided by price. The quoted spread is it on the top and the effective spread on the bottom. You don't see such a big change when the minimum tick size change. What you do see, though, is quite a bit of more variation, and that's, of course, caused by price variation. So price variation over time, which is the denominator of this number, causes these things to swing around a bit. You also see that there's a discontinuity at every calendar year, and that's caused by the fact that we kept stocks for a whole year and then changed a new set of stocks every calendar year. Well, here's a similar plot for depth. The top graph is dollar depth. In other words, it's the price multiplied by the number of shares that were quoted, guaranteed. And that tends to have quite a bit of fluctuation. You can also see that there's a big impact of the minimum tick size on depth. The share depth is on the bottom, and that minimum tick size also changed on that same day. This effect on depth was actually predicted in a paper by Larry Harris some years ago. He had a paper in the Journal of Finance that predicted that if the minimum tick size is one of the leading things that caused depth to change because of people front-running the specialists or the market makers when the minimum tick size is lower. So I expect the same thing would be more pronounced now that the New York Stock Exchange has gone to a 1 cent minimum tick size, that you would see quite a bit further reduction in depth just in the recent past, which we hope to be able to find out when we get the data. Here's here are the figures for volume over time. On the top graph, the orange colored ones are the share volume. Of course, you can see that they're growing, especially in the last part of the 1990s, from about 94 on. And the bottom graph is dollar volume. Those two things coincide quite a bit. If you look at how much fluctuation there is from day to day, it's really quite astonishing, because these have already been averaged over all the trades during the day. It's the sum of all trades during the day and then averaged over all stocks in the market. And there's a tremendous amount of day-to-day volatility in those numbers. And finally, here's a graph which gives you, on the top is the average trade size, and the vertical axis for the average trade size is there on the right. So this is in thousands of dollars. So the midline there is about $60,000. You can see that the average trade size declined, and then it went up from about 1991 to 1996, and then has come down a bit. And we think that what's happened since around 1996 is the average trade size has declined because of internet trading. There's been a lot more small investors that have been doing trades, and they tend to have smaller trade size, and that's kind of reflected in this last couple of years in the graph. On the bottom of this graph, in the rust colored plot, you see the number of trades per day, the vertical axis on the left there. Remember that on average, the average stock had around 109 trades per day. And so that this is 100. You see it was below that back in 88, and now it's around 200 trades per day. So there's been quite a bit of increase in the number of trades as well. Of course, the number of trades is not dollar-driven, so there's no inflation problem here. In the paper, we actually did correct for inflation in those cases where there would be a possible secular trend because of price level changes, but that wouldn't affect these things here. Well, let's go back to what explains these things. I think now you've seen that there's a lot of movement in liquidity over time. Can we explain some of it by standard paradigms in market microstructure? First candidate would be interest rates. The interest rates come in here because market makers have to finance their inventories, and they may have to be financing them at rates which are subject to risk. There may be default risk involved. So what we think about is looking at interest rate levels, also looking at short versus long-term interest rates, and looking at quality spreads, that is, default spreads on corporate bonds as a possible determinant. Equity movements would also be a candidate for determinant. The current return, for instance, the return on the same day may be correlated with a change in liquidity. We normally think of that as we hit a huge negative return, liquidity dries up. That'd be the kind of thing that we'd expect there. But also, recent trends will affect liquidity. For instance, we know that a lot of people trade on momentum or are contrarian traders. So if there's a recent upswing in the markets, you might have momentum traders increasing their trading activity, and that'll have an effect on liquidity. And of course, volatility, the more volatile the general conditions are in the market, that should certainly affect how market makers quote spreads and also how general liquidity and trading activity varies. Another candidate would be seasonals. For instance, the day of the week. Can we show that there are different levels of liquidity depending on which day of the week it is or whether it's near a holiday or not? Macro announcements would be a proxy, the best proxy that we can have, given that we can't really detect inside information. We'd like to have some proxy for insider trading so that we could get some information about, we could get some asymmetric information variables in here. We couldn't really come up with anything very persuasive, so we thought, well, what about looking at macroeconomic announcements with the thought that at least some people might know in advance what the government's going to say about the unemployment rate or the consumer price index or so on, and that will have an effect on liquidity. So let me define then exactly how we're going to measure these things. The market return is going to be the return, we're going to separate into a positive return and a negative return. It's going to be either the maximum of zero in the return on an equal weighted crisp index or the negative component of that. So we're going to separate the contemporary's return into upswings and downswings. We're going to look at a moving average of the market return over 5 days prior to the liquidity that we're going to try to explain. We're going to also look at a moving average of the absolute value of the market return. That's a volatility measure. We're going to look at dummy variables for days of the week and for holidays, for days which are adjacent to holidays. In the U.S., my favorite example is the Friday after Thanksgiving, which always comes on a Thursday. Okay, people go home on Thursday and they come back on Friday. At least some people do. But, you know, as we'll see, not very many people do. Short-term interest rate is the federal funds yield change. So we're looking at daily changes in all these things. And so we're going to look at the change in the short rate, the change in the spread of the 10-year bond over the federal funds rate, the change in corporate versus the 10-year treasury spread, that's a default variable, and a macroeconomic announcement dummy, which is going to be on the announcement day, there's going to be one, and a different one for 2 days prior to the macro announcement date, with the thought that there should be some effect on liquidity when a macroeconomic announcement is imminent. And the three macro announcements that we document have to do with gross domestic product, unemployment, and the CPI, these being ones that we know move the market price quite a bit. All right, so now what I want to do is show you a regression where the dependent variable is the percent change from day to day in the liquidity numbers, and the independent variables are variables that I just showed you. This is the idea here is we're trying to figure out if we can explain with these proxies some of the daily movements in stock prices. So this panel, which I hope you can read, although it must be pretty small at the back there, has three different dependent variables. The first column is the percentage change in the quoted spread. The second is the percentage change in the effective spread. And the third is depth. So if you look at the first column, you'll see that contemporaneous market movements do, in fact, have a very significant impact on the quoted spread. And this number here, the second one, is the down market movement. Its T statistic is minus 22. What that says is that when you have a significant down day in the market, that's a negative return, that's multiplied by a negative coefficient, the quoted spread widens rather dramatically. When you have an upmarket movement, that coefficient's also negative, the quoted spread narrows because you have a positive number multiplied by this negative coefficient. But you can see from this is that the effect in an upmarket is quite a bit less than the effect in a downmarket. In fact, it's something like 7 times more pronounced in upmarkets, in downmarkets, than it is in upmarkets. The same thing is true of the effective spread, which is the two middle columns there. That's the coefficient on the left and the t-statistic on the right. And then on depth, which is the final two columns, you see just the opposite. When you have a down market, there's a positive coefficient, so depth decreases. That means liquidity dries up in a down market. An up market, it increases. So again, you have the same kind of pattern. Let me draw your attention next, skip over the moving average coefficients for the market. There is a slight impact in the effective spread of the recent trend, and there's a pretty substantial effect on depth of the recent trend, but those coefficients tend to be much less significant. There's not much effect. There's some effect of volatility. That's the moving average of the absolute market return, the fifth row in the column. But to our surprise, one of the strongest patterns that we found were these dummy variables for days of the week. For instance, you see the T statistic for Tuesday for the quoted spread is minus 11. And what that says is that on Tuesdays, spreads narrow. Liquidity gets better on Tuesdays relative to Mondays, and depth increases. You can see those midweek coefficients are negative and very significant for the midweek days, and for depth just the opposite, positive and very significant, which tells you immediately that you would never want to trade on Friday if you can avoid it. What you should do is to never, if you're going to be an investor that can trade, you know, one day or the other, just stay away from Friday. That's a terrible day to trade. Monday's a little better, but not nearly as good as Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So when you keep that in mind when you're ready to try to go out and get better terms on your deal, you will definitely do better in the middle of the week. If you take a look at the holiday number, it's also extremely significant. Liquidity is very poor on days adjacent to holidays, just before holidays or just after holidays. And we'll see that affect us also. It's one of the larger effects in the table. There's a change in depth of about 5% relative to a typical day on a day around a holiday. Now, in the bottom of the table, you can see that the interest rate variables do have an effect. An increase in the short rate of interest raises the spread and lowers liquidity. And the term spread is also significant, the opposite for depth. And there's even some significance for the GDP announcements, particularly on depth. You can see that the unemployment rate has a pretty significant effect on depth, and the GDP announcement also does, although it doesn't have much effect on the spread variables. So here's a similar set of regressions for trading activity, and this kind of mirrors the liquidity. You can see that, for instance, there's a big impact of contemporaneous market moves on the dollar volume and on the number of trades that occur across a whole market during a day. There's a large effect of volatility and of recent price movements. There's a big seasonal effect, a pretty big interest rate effect, and some important GDP announcement effects on volatility. So when you look at this, when you look at these regressions and you look at the R-squares that are printed at the bottom, we were able to explain with these variables roughly 20-30% of that enormous day-to-day change that we have in these variables. So that means that in most cases we've got, let's say, 70-80% of this day-to-day variation is left unexplained, and I'd be happy to entertain any other variables that people might want to consider if we could measure them to try to explain more of this. There's plenty of volatility left unexplained. Before I go on to the order imbalance thing, I just want to mention that this quote, liquidity begets liquidity. For instance, liquidity seasonals are self-perpetuating. They're not like arbitrage opportunities. If traders believe there's going to be low liquidity during a particular period, liquidity might go down even further. So for instance, suppose I told you that Friday was a bad day to go trading because the liquidity is low, and you all believe that, you'd stop trading on Friday and that'd make things even worse. It's not the kind of thing that can be erased, at least in a first order arbitrage way. It's just the opposite of return seasonals. So questions for future research. Do interest rates and equity return differentially influence the liquidity of small and large firms? Yes, we can answer that now. Are day of the week effects more prevalent in active or inactive stocks? Yes, we know the answer to that. Do default spreads influence the liquidity of small new companies? No, we haven't been able to find that. Are liquidity variations related to time series properties of daily returns? That's a very interesting question that we haven't yet pinned down. And finally, are liquidity shocks systematic risk? Are they priced in expected returns? There have been several papers recently that have tried to develop theories of liquidity as a systematic factor in explaining the cross-section of expected returns. And I believe that there's going to be a good bit of more research on that question. And I think that it's large enough to have a big effect. And finally, how are these regularities related to order and balance, which is I'm going to show you some of this in a second. But before I do that, I got to start my other... paper, because it's a different one. The paper that you just saw is coming out in the Journal of Finance in the next, we've seen the galleys already, so it's going to appear soon. And the next paper that we're working on, the same authors, has to do with order imbalances and how that relates to liquidity. What are order imbalances? Well, the intuition here is that the market maker standing there ready to trade, to either buy or sell, and people come from outside with a lot of stocks to buy or a lot of stocks to sell, and there's an imbalance in the outsider's orders between buyers and sellers. So obviously, if there are a lot of buyers relative to sellers, then what's going to happen is that the price is going to go up with the stock, vice versa if there are a lot of sellers relative to buyers. So What we want to work on in this paper is that the effect on liquidity may not just be volume related, just activity related, but it also related to how these imbalances occur day to day. And these imbalances, which we'll show you, we are able to measure, will affect market-wide price movements and also liquidity on an aggregate basis. So here I'm talking about now not just individual stocks, but how order imbalances aggregated over all stocks in the market make markets move and make liquidity change on a day-to-day basis. The key empirical findings that I'm going to show you the support for in just a moment is that the daily order imbalances on aggregate level, so if we add up all this thing over the whole market, are strongly autocorrelated, so that if we see excessive buying on a given day, that predicts excessive buying on the next day and the next day after that. Those are strongly autocorrelated. Of course, returns are not. And so this raises the interesting issue is, how do arbitrageurs take into account these order imbalances so that the prices change immediately and there no longer is any autocorrelation in prices, even though those order imbalances continue for quite a long time? Basically, buying or selling follows market changes. We see excessive buying following market declines and excessive selling following market rises. Again, this is for the general market, which means that on balance, investors are contrarians. They're selling and buying in response to recent market moves, and there's a strong pattern, which I'll show you, of this. This is interesting because it doesn't do them any good, because returns are not autocorrelated, but they must believe that it does them good, or else they wouldn't be doing this. Excessive buy or sell orders do reduce liquidity, as you might imagine. I'll show you the reason for that. Order imbalances strongly affect returns in the expected direction. In other words, if excessive buys, prices go up, excessive sells, they go down. And surprisingly, there is a bit of predictability for future returns. So there is a trading strategy that there is at least a slight bit of evidence that you can use these things to predict future. And finally, order imbalances strongly affect absolute returns, even after controlling for volume. But we expected this. People who've studied the relation between volatility and volume have missed something important. Obviously, volatility is affected when you have a lot of volume, but only if there's an imbalance in orders. Because if you've got a huge day when half the people want to buy and half the people want to sell, and that cancels out with each other, there's no reason why you should have a lot of volatility. So we'll see that in fact, is true. Again, the same data that we had before. NYSE listed stocks. Go through this quickly because I'm getting close to the 1 hour. And the market returns I'm going to show you in this paper are the S&P 500 index returns. It's a valuated index, and we picked it because it's a tough target. The autocorrelation coefficient in this index is 0.005 during this period. It has no non-synchronous trading problems and other things that we didn't want to fool with. And the liquidity number we're going to use here is the average quoted spread. But this time, we're going to evaluate the individual quoted spreads by the weights that are in the S&P index. So it's going to correspond to like a quoted spread for the S&P stocks and so on. Now here's the key thing is, how do we determine what an order imbalance is? We need a way when we see a trade to determine whether or not that was a sell order coming from the outside or a buy order coming from the outside. Now in some markets, you can know that. You know which side the market maker took and which side the outsiders took. In the New York data, we don't know that, so we need to figure out a way to try to deduce that. Fortunately, there was a method invented by Lee and Reddy in 1991, which is called the Lee-Reddy algorithm. It assigns a trade to a buyer if the price is closer to the ask and vice versa. The quote must be at least 5 seconds old, and if the trade is at the midpoint of the quote, then there's a tick test which assigns it to either a buyer or seller initiated trade if the last price change prior to trade is positive. So this is not our algorithm, but it's an algorithm that's been studied empirically and found to be fairly accurate in assigning trades to whether or not they were buyer or seller initiated. So what we have here is aggregated order imbalances on day T, and we've got three different kinds. The total number of trades, which are the number of buyer less the number of seller initiated trades. Then we have the number of shares, the buyer-initiated shares purchased less seller-initiated shares sold. Then we have dollars, total dollars paid by buyers less dollars received by sellers. So these are people outside the market. Now what we did is we aggregated this on a given day for all stocks in the S&P 500, and that's the number that I'm going to show you. All aggregates are value weighted by the S&P weights. Well, here's some order and balance statistics to just give you an idea what they look like. On average, the order and balance was positive during this time period. The mean value of the number of trades on a given day was about 34.9. Well, you see, this is a period when stock prices generally went up, so you expect a little bit more order positive than negative order imbalances. The bottom of this table gives you the absolute values of these levels. Of course, they're much larger because that's kind of a measure of volatility. Here are the cross correlations between the order imbalance numbers and the S&P returns on the top, and the autocorrelations in the numbers in the bottom. I mentioned to you before at the beginning that one of the key things that we found is that these order imbalance figures are strongly positively autocorrelated. I only gave you a lag out to 5 days here, but if you take a look at those autocorrelations, they're not decaying very much as we go back in time. In fact, you go all the way out to lag 20, they're still significant. So what this means is that somebody out there, even on a market aggregate basis, believes that even 20 days later, something happens in the market, then they're going to keep trading. Either they're watching other people trading and mimicking them, or watching price changes and mimicking them. You can see the autocorrelation in the S&P 500 is zero, and as we saw before, it's negative in the quoted spread. That last column there is the percentage change in the order imbalance number, and that's negatively autocorrelated. Well, let me show you some I hope you can see this, but basically, this is a regression which reports, which tries to explain the order imbalance on a given day, first by seasonal variables, which is in the first panel, second by lagged negative and positive market returns, which are in the second and third panels. And believe it or not, this regression explains 47.7% of the volatility in the order imbalance. It's a purely predictive regression. So what this says is that with a very simple model, you can explain roughly half of tomorrow's order imbalance on the New York Stock Exchange in aggregate by what happened by the day of the week and by what happened on the 5 preceding days. Well, you know, when you think about this, it's really that doesn't mean you can explain the return, of course, because the order imbalance and the return, the explanatory ability in the order imbalance should be taken into account by arbitrageurs when they set prices. But you can explain a very large part of how people are trading on a given day by what happened in the recent past. Now you notice that the contrarian idea is there. If you look at the middle panel, those coefficients are all negative and significant, which means when stocks went down in the past, people buy. And when they went up in the past, people sell. Well, that's basically the thing in order imbalance. What about liquidity in order imbalances? Well, here's a regression that explains the dependent variable is the percentage change in the quoted spread on a given day. The explanatory variables are order imbalances, the percentage change in the number of trades, the contemporaneous movement in the market, and the absolute value of that. And the first regression is contemporaneous. The second one attempts to explain the percentage change in the next day's quoted spread number. It's a nonlinear relationship. So you can see, though, that there's a lot of statistical power in a contemporaneous basis. And order imbalance does, in fact, cause liquidity to change. The bigger the order imbalance in absolute value in either direction, whether it's excessive buys or excessive sells, liquidity as measured by the quoted spread gets worse. The quoted spread widens. And there's some ability to explain this on the next day as well, although that the explanatory power is a little bit weaker. If we try to explain the percentage change in the quoted spread tomorrow by the order imbalance and the percentage change in trades and so on, here's the result there. Now let's look at what happens with market returns in orders. The dependent variable in this regression is going to be the S&P return on a given day, and you got to look at this carefully, but the first two variables here are the order imbalances to buy or order imbalances to sell on a given day. So each one of these is a separate regression. The dependent variable is the same in all of those. Take a look at these numbers here. This is excessive sell orders on the same day, and this is excessive buy orders in the same day. This coefficient is roughly 3 times bigger. What this tells us is that excessive sell orders have a much bigger effect on the market return than excessive buy orders do. They drive the market return down, excessive sell orders do. The t-statistic is 20, and that is very significant. If you look at the next two numbers, those are the same variables lag by one day, and they're included in this regression. There's a bounce back effect. So if you have excessive sell orders a day, it drives the price down, but the next day that tends to come back. So, and that's why that's significant. The second regression there includes lagged positive and negative market returns. So this regression here has two contemporaneous coefficients, two lagged order imbalances, two lagged returns. Those lagged returns are highly significant. So when you first think about that, it looks like you're able to predict the market return. But don't forget, in order to apply that regression, you have to know what the order imbalance is on the same day. If you knew that, like the specialist does in the New York Stock Exchange, that would be a very successful predictive regression for returns. But look what happens when you throw out the contemporaneous variables. Those things drop out. So that third column there is what we could do as non-exchange members in terms of predicting returns with order imbalances. It's interesting, though, that the lag positive and negative market returns still show up. So that if you take into account the order imbalances, there's some dependence in that market return. Remember that the serial correlation to market return was virtually zero, not accounting for order imbalances, and here we detect it to be somewhat significant, although look at the explanatory power, the R-square is 0.00, the adjusted R-square is 0.008. Well, here's a plot that shows on the horizontal axis order imbalances, buyer-initiated less seller-initiated trades, the S&P 500 return on the same day. On the vertical axis, you can see that it's a nice positive scatter. If you take the log on the horizontal axis, it makes it a little bit more linear. This is what the return is on the previous day on the vertical axis, and the return on the next day on the horizontal axis. Turns out that there's some predictive power there. It's very modest and probably not enough to worry about, but we did find, looking at future market returns after extremes, where we looked at order imbalance in the top quintile and returns in the top quintile, or days with order imbalance in the bottom quintile and the bottom quintile and return in the bottom quintile, that we can predict the next day's return. You see that RT plus 1 is a dependent variable. And in fact, this last regression on the right-hand side is a predictive equation. It's got an R-square of about 10. So when you see days when there's a strong excessive sell orders and very big negative returns, you can predict fairly successfully what the S&P 500 return is going to be the next day. When I say successfully, R-square of about 10%. Finally, this is a regression looking at the volatility of returns. So on the left side of this regression are the absolute values of the returns. And in the explanatory variables include order imbalances to buy or sell, dollar volume, quoted spreads, lagged absolute returns. And if you look at the first column, it's contemporaneous. The second column predicts the future absolute return. There's a big effect on volatility of the contemporaneous order imbalance, but not very much on the future. And this is in addition to the effect of volume. The people before have looked at volatility and volume have actually missed something here, because you, by signing the returns, you can do better. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for an extremely lucid presentation. Professor Roll will now take a few questions. If you could put your hand up. Have a question? Oh.
Did all of you up there hear the question? Or? None of you heard them. Okay. I think the question was, could we consider emerging market debt spreads or something like that as an explanatory variable for liquidity, given that we've noticed the peso crisis and the Russian debt crisis and so on being major episodes of events when we think liquidity did change? I've not done that. I think that's a very good idea. We can certainly get the spread data for, let's say, Brady bonds from Mexico and stuff like that. And just knowing the episodes as they happen, you know, you think that would work pretty well to explain some of the stuff that was left unexplained. Yeah. Yes.
It's not a very large change when you change the minimum tick size in New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
That thing was cut in half then, like from 8 to 16.
Right.
It's now going down by 6 times that amount.
That's right.
Well,
I hope not. There wouldn't be any depth left at the in the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, we're already down to 3,000 shares from 6,000 shares on average. So if you had the same linear extrapolation, you know, there'd be practically no depth at all. So, they've been carrying on now for a couple of months with a penny as the minimum tick size, and there has been definitely a decrease in depth. But I haven't yet compiled all the numbers. I don't think it's going to be. You know, I don't think you can linearly extrapolate it, though. But okay, the question for all you is, what effect does my academic research, particularly about liquidity, have on my activity as a fund manager? Well, I don't trade on Fridays or the Thursday after Thanksgiving. Or, you know, we actually tried to pay some attention to this trading-wise, because obviously, I know you're well aware, Savan, that trading costs for a portfolio manager, a professional manager, who's an active manager, are very, very significant in terms of the performance that the manager has relative to the benchmark. And they can constitute probably 30 or 40 or 50% of any performance numbers that you turn in. So you're really very, very cognizant of minimizing trading costs if you can do that. What I mean by 30 or 40, let's suppose that I think I can beat the benchmark by 300 basis points per annum, but I have to turn over the portfolio 100% per annum to do that. Right? Well, if I paid 200 basis points in trading costs versus 100 basis points in trading costs, my clients are going to be much happier with the latter. So, there are quite a few firms I think you know in all over the world that provide
money managers with data about their execution costs. And you know, we employ a couple of those in my own firm. So they look at every single trade and look at what our actual expenses are and help us try to minimize those things. But yeah, we don't. I try to avoid doing any trading except in midweek in particular, and also not after, not around major macroeconomic announcement dates, and not after the market has run up or down quite a bit. How could it be offset? Is that the question? I didn't quite hear the question. Huh? Yeah. Okay, the question is how the problem of less of depth being reduced when you have a smaller tick size, what regulations could we impose to overcome that? Is that the question? I don't know. Do you have any ideas? Well, one regulation is you could forbid the stock exchange to have a minimum tick size lower than some number that you think would provide adequate depth. I don't know. Is it true in London that the regulators have to approve the minimum tick size? Or is that purely an exchange option? There's no minimum tick size? Well, your minimum tick size is higher than ours then, since the pound is $1.45. So. Do you have more depth than the... But there's no regulatory intervention in the in that question here? Yeah. I don't know if there's any other way to do it than to impose a... Now, the exchange could choose to do that, of course, and that, you know, they may go back to that if it turns out that liquidity really is a lot worse. Yeah. Actually, you know, there's no way we... I mean, I think that's a good point, is that people split up their trades. You have a big trade, you might split it up into a bunch of smaller trades. And so when you see that when the New York Stock Exchange provides you with the transactions data, they don't tell you whether that was done by one entity that's, you know, in a bunch of trades in sequence. So there's no way we can control for that. However, some of these companies in the U.S. that provide services for money managers have the money managers' own trades, and they have big databases of these, and they do look at this question. It definitely will affect the effective spread, and also the depth, of course, is just the quoted depth. It's not really what a big trader could expect to do when you come in the market. If they quote 6,000 shares and you have 100,000 to do, they may be good for 100,000, depending on the stock and whether or not they think you have any information or not. But I'm sure that this is one reason why when you try to explain these gigantic percentage daily changes in these things, that you only explain, you know, 20 or 30% of it rather than much more. If you knew more of that kind of thing, you'd do a much better job, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, okay, the question is how, whether or not liquidity, broadly defined, could become an element that would explain some part of the expected cross-sectional differences in return. And here's a way that, that we've been thinking about it, is that stocks differ cross-sectionally in their susceptibility to these random changes in liquidity. Those random changes in liquidity are kind of like systematic risks, because if you if you have a stock, for instance, I as a money manager faced with trading a stock that's got a lot of volatility and liquidity, I probably will pay less for that stock up front, because when the time comes I want to sell it, you know, I may have to wait longer to execute that order. So if changes in liquidity represent a systematic risk, and you could have a beta for that systematic risk, it seems to me conceivable, at least, that some part of the expected return could be ascribed to that systematic risk that's there for liquidity shocks. Now, there are some papers, some new papers that have been trying to develop this as a theory and even measure it empirically. I mean, there's old work by Amahud and Mendelssohn, you know, do you know that, those papers that go back a few years, but I think there really is probably something to this. I've seen some recent papers that seem to say that they can improve on explaining the cross-section of returns by adding as an additional factor this unexpected liquidity shock that stocks have different susceptibilities to.
This Richard, not come to you.
Yeah, we actually did look at, I didn't show you numbers, but we did look at stuff like the beginning of the year, you know, where you have these abnormal things in monthly seasonals. We did not find anything there. So I was surprised. I thought we would find a summer, winter effect. Yeah, you know, the Halloween indicator or whatever, you know, but we didn't, you know, maybe we didn't look at the right seasonal, I don't know, but we didn't find a monthly one anyway. No. I think that every market is going to have, whether or not there's an official market maker, like the New York Stock Exchange is an official market maker. Even on markets where there's no official market maker, people take over the role and act as market makers. You know, when you say order-driven markets, I mean, we could have electronic markets like in Taipei where there's really no official or designated market maker, and yet some people, some individuals, you know, take on that role. I think the only difference between the New York Exchange and that is that the New York Stock Exchange gives a monopoly right to the specialist to be the market maker. So that probably would have some effect on, you know, the level of spreads and stuff that are charged. But I don't know that there would be any real change other than the level of spreads in the liquidity. What I'm thinking of is trying to distinguish between the percentage changes, the daily changes in liquidity, these movements over time, versus kind of the level of the charges exerted by the market makers. I don't know for sure, but my intuition says that there wouldn't be that much of a difference. Okay, the question was, coming from Slovenia, is that where you have very low liquidity? And what was the second part of that? To increase volatility? To increase liquidity? Well, you know, liquidity is a good thing, right? Everybody wants to have liquidity. So the incentive, the stock exchange, you talk to officials of the stock exchange, they all want very high liquidity all the time, right? I don't know whether your question is, why wouldn't they have, we ask about an incentive. I mean, obviously they have an incentive to have this. The question is how they accomplish that. And, you know, when you have, let's say, I know that there, I don't know Slovenia in particular, but I know a lot of other, and trade in a lot of other very small markets around the world where trades don't even occur daily or even monthly sometimes. I mean, we can go for 6 months without a trade, right? So that's taking to a liquidity. I don't know what you do in a case like that where there's only one trade every 6 months, whether you can do anything. So. No, no, I think you went a little too far. I was with you till the transaction cost zero part. So are you quoting negative spreads then? Can they? Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you all heard the question. Did you up there? He was talking about the foreign exchange market and pointed out that it's, you know, by all odds, it's the biggest market in terms of trading in the world. $1 trillion a day, or more than that, I think, isn't it? And, very thin, very, very low, very low spreads, very high volume, and spreads even negative sometimes. Well, you know, I think though that the same issues arise there that would arise in the stock exchange in terms of how do you explain the day-to-day change in trading activity and other measures of liquidity. We obviously have major liquidity crises in foreign exchange markets. Every now and then, maybe not so much in pound sterling dollar, but you know, in the rupiah and the, you know, the ringgit and stuff, you know, I'm sure you could name a lot more than I did. And those kind of things that change day to day, I would think could be explainable by some kind of underlying macroeconomic influences and things like interest rates and stuff like that. And the interest to the traders involved, it would be interesting to know what causes these fluctuations over time in liquidity. Why is it that bid-ask spreads are negative sometimes and positive other times? And how does that coincide with recent changes in rates? So I don't think that there's any, you know, substantial difference on a quantitative level. There's a big difference, but on a qualitative level, the same kind of factors would be interesting to I'd personally be very interested in seeing something like this done for foreign exchange, because it is such a liquid and, you know, large market that it'd be probably a good market to study in this way.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank you, the audience, for all of your questions and for your attendance, but I'd like to extend the usual vote of thanks to Professor Rolle for what I think has been an extremely interesting hour and 20 minutes. Thank you very much. Excuse me, before you all dash out, there is a reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor of this building, which the young can walk to and the old like me can take the lift to. Okay.